Well, and welcome to a special edition of Talk Back. We do this a couple times a month. It's the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. Joining us here in studio, Bob Seidenschwartz. Good morning, Bob.
Hey, good morning, Peter. How are you?
Excellent, sir. How's it going?
Doing well, thank you. Good to be here again.
We have a guest in studio that you brought with us from the Missoula College, once known as the College of Technology, or the VOTEC. Mm-hmm. If you want to really go back a long way. So Dr. Bradley Layton, Professor Bradley Layton, here with us this morning. Welcome.
Peter, thanks. Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, get right on that microphone.
Okay.
All right, we're talking technology here. So,
all right, I'm
now,
on the mic.
Let's talk for a second about what do you do at the Missoula College? What do you teach?
Sure. So I direct the energy technology program.
Excellent.
The program is 5 or 6 years old now, and so we teach a variety of classes, courses, the majority of which focus on renewable and sustainable energy technologies. We also have a good partnership with the main campus. So we've got former provost Jim Staub, who teaches our fossil fuels course, and we also have a partnership with the climate change mm-hmm. studies program. So it's really integrated with the entire University of Montana.
I wanted to ask Bradley to give a little background. How did these programs start? Because I don't remember if 10 years ago the programs existed here in Missoula. So what was the impetus for starting these programs? And I also saw that on your bio, that there's some integration with the climate change program over at the university too, which is now is it a four-year degree program?
Well, the climate change studies is a minor. There's a sort of a small subgroup of courses. It's run out of the forestry mm-hmm. department, College of Forestry. But the initial impetus for the program, there was a grant that our former dean at Missoula College had gotten, and one of the outcomes was to bring some sustainable energy to Missoula. So you'll probably see when you come into town, there's a wind turbine in the Hellgate Canyon. There's also a solar panel. There's also a hydrogen fueling station there, and I think that's when California was on this big kick to go to a hydrogen economy, if you will. But really, it was funded initially out of the Department of Commerce, and one of the outcomes was to develop this energy technology program that's trying to see what's sort of next in energy technology. So, like I said, we teach the entire suite of renewables, geothermals in there, fuel cells is in there.
Now, I remember Dr. Paul Williamson?
Paul Williamson, yeah, was the former dean.
Was there for quite some time, and he and I had some fascinating discussions about, and at this time, this was a couple years ago, and this whole hydrogen technology was really, a lot of folks thought it was really out there, but he was a forward-looking guy, and he said, just give it a couple of years, and this will be much more mainstream.
Yeah, so kind of the running joke with hydrogen, it's the fuel of the future, and it's always going to be the fuel of the future. But I think as we get into the show here, we'll see. As fossil fuels become more scarce, you'll see things like hydrogen, biomass, solar, wind become more mainstream.
Now, when do you think that will happen? The scarcity thing. I remember 12 years ago as a debater, I was told that peak oil or peak coal were going to happen in like 4 or 5 years, and now it's another 12 years later, and
that's
they're projecting even more.
It's like Doritos
supplies.
We'll make more. You know what I mean?
Right. So what do you think about that? I mean, that's been the constant theme. The mantra has been when these energy supplies that we believe are limited go out of existence, then the price of wind and hydro will come up to match. That hasn't happened and doesn't look likely in the near future.
Yeah, it's true. Especially with some of the things that we've seen. On this continent, with the Bakken, and there will continue to be oil discoveries. But if you sort of look at the what's happened, there was a publication in National Geographic a few years ago that showed the big discoveries. Showed the big Middle Eastern discoveries, and it just based on statistics, it looks very unlikely that we'll have any large discoveries for oil. So it'll fluctuate. It'll go up and down, as new technologies come online for extracting, deeper, less accessible oil. But it's finite. I think it's hard to make an argument about that.
Now, may I just jump in here a second? Because what we've heard about, I want to know where you stand, what you believe about the Keystone XL pipeline. Oh. I mean, they want to build it from Canada, part of it going through Montana. Now, some of the protests regarding this are not just the fact that there may be leaks in the pipeline, which every pipeline leaks every now and then.
Of course.
But but simply the fact of the kind of oil that is being extracted through the sands. They say it's dirty, it's harder to refine, it's more polluting. So, from your perspective, as someone who is looking at these things, you know, daily,
right,
and has a lot more education than most of us, what do you think about that?
Well, the reason that we're going after the tar sands now rather than 1850 is just we didn't have the technology. Mm-hmm. So the very first oil discoveries was sort of like Beverly Hillbillies. You go out there, you're hunting, and the oil comes gushing out of the ground.
Through the ground? Right.
Titusville, Pennsylvania. It literally was bubbling out of the ground.
That's right.
And it was called shale oil.
Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, sources like that were extremely accessible. There's a very high return on investment, if you will. And so, as we've used up those sort of shallow, easy, high pressure, we've had to go to, more and more extreme technologies, you know, with offshore drilling and things like that, and really just squeezing oil out of these tar sands. So it's only now becoming economically viable to go after these because there's less of it left.
There's an acronym, EROEI, Energy Return on Energy Invested. And if you go back to the early days of energy development, for one barrel of oil, you could extract 100 barrels.
That's right, Bob.
And that has declined to the point now one barrel of oil is extracting 3 to 5 barrels.
That's right.
So when you're talking about finite, there still may be, and I suspect, an awful lot of oil or fossil fuels to be extracted, but the cost. That's and the right. environmental issues. So what if there's a lot of oil under the ice caps? And we assume that the ice caps now are breaking up so that you can get access. And in fact, many of the majors are looking at this. And that's an area of major dispute
So basically taking advantage of, if there is global warming, quote unquote, they could take advantage of that by getting to the resources that were hitherto unavailable.
It wasn't economical. It wasn't practical.
Okay.
But then you have other issues too, such as, who owns the rights?
Right, right.
You've got Russia, you've got Canada, you've got the United States, you've got Norway and some of the countries that bordered this area.
Norway's
going to
take it.
I mean, these are big, these are legal issues, these are territorial issues, and of course they're environmental issues.
Well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're up against a break here, but I want to get our listeners involved here. This is fascinating, and this is a gentleman that actually... a very impressive resume. I was looking at you. You went to MIT. You were at Drexel, University of Michigan. Now you're here at the University of Montana, and I'm wondering if all those places that you spent time in, and now you're working in the College of Technology, in the facilities that you've had to put up with for quite some time now, mm-hmm. I want to ask you, are you looking forward to some new stuff here pretty quick?
We are, in fact, Peter, and thanks for the compliment there. We are applying for the Department of Labor grant, so we've been putting in grants to the National Science Foundation to gain access to better facilities, better labs, and also early this spring we're going to be putting in a Department of Labor grant to do the same thing, to put in labs for better training and better education for our students.
Where would those labs go? Where would they go?
Oh, well, so right now we have one small lab over at Montech. This is on Broadway, so right the Montana Technology Enterprise Center. I've also been using a couple labs on main campus, but the plan, it looks like we've sort of got through the legislature on the new building.
The money's available. We just need to figure out where to put it.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's
7.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
So the golf course issue has been something that's been in a lot of newspapers, and I weighed in on it not too long ago, and I love to play golf, and I hope there's a way that we can have the building there and maintain the golf course.
Well, someone said just build it under the golf course.
Well, I was thinking up on the hill, actually. I thought maybe a Highlands course, something where it's a little more challenging, and you got a view while you're playing.
So. Yeah, or you could put the college right directly into the hill.
That would work, too.
Because that way you're energy efficient. You've got the whole geothermal thing going.
It would face a little bit west, but if we could cheat it around the corner and face a little more south, that'd be all right.
Well, Peter, there's got to be some moss or a flower that is an endangered species on the hill.
There's
into the hillside.
There's some endangered dirt there somewhere. Anyway,
right.
We're going to come right back. We have all three lines open. If you'd like to visit with Dr. Bradley Layden, who is right here at the Missoula College and really on the cutting edge of a lot of this new technology, what do you think? 721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. We'd love to take your calls. Dr. Layden would love to take your calls and want to know what you think. We'll be right back with more of Talk Back in a moment. Welcome back to Talk Back, 721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. It's the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. John King's over there without a microphone.
I steal Bob's.
Okay, there you go. Bob Seidenschwartz with us, and of course, Dr. Bradley Layton is with us from the Missoula College. And Mark is waiting on the line to visit with our guest. Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Good morning. Just fine, Peter. Thank you.
What's on your mind?
Is the gentleman aware of our president and our oh-so-competent and ethical State Department promoting fracking technology in Poland?
Fracking technology in Poland. No, that's a new one for me.
Yeah. There was, and I'm foggy, I can't remember, it was PBS or the Journal, the Deutsche Welle broadcaster out of Germany had an article on it, and it's become very big there, and it looks like they're literally ramming it down the populace throat.
Well,
I can speak to that a little bit. From an investment standpoint, I'm aware of several companies that have made forays into Poland for developing some of the gas in the shale areas, not with great success.
I have the article here. This is from The Guardian, and it says, Poland stands on the brink of a boom in fracking for shale gas, but will it be an environmental curse or an economic blessing? Chris Faulkner is an oil man from Dallas, Texas, and his company, Breeling Oil and Gas, is a major player in the burgeoning shale gas sector, and this is in Poland.
Right.
So Poland does not have a good history of other countries taking an interest in it.
This is true.
Right, and the caller is correct in saying that there has been some aggressive attempts by the government to basically get access to land for this. So it's not without controversy, but I would ask the caller, when you make this comment, what is your point, or where are you leading us with this comment of yours?
Well, my point is, why is the president promoting something like that overseas when his base is trying to kill it here in the States?
Well, now how do we know that it's the president and his administration that are pushing this and not just private enterprise?
They had a clip of him giving a speech in Poland about the technology and how wonderful it was going to be for them to develop it over there, and the assistance that the United States was going to give them.
Interesting.
And yeah, I'm sure that has a lot to do with the politics of what we have to deal with here in this country. Also in Europe, keep in mind, too, that Russia supplies Europe with the majority of its natural gas at the current time. So there's always the geopolitical angle, which is if Poland and other countries become independent by being producers of natural gas separate from what they need to take from Russia, that drives a bit of a wedge economically and politically. So there's a lot of different parts of the game that are taking place right now.
Yeah, so it'd be a political gambit, basically, to maybe just turn our back a little bit on what's happening in America so for a little bit of political advantage in Europe.
Right. I don't want to think too deeply about this since there's many different angles, but
sure.
I do know that on that point that I just made, that there's a great deal of accuracy.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks for the call, Mark. Appreciate that. All right.
Well, I had a quick question for Mr. Layton.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about kind of fringe technologies or new future technologies.
Sure.
Geothermal, I think, is up there for a lot of people in consideration. I used to live in Japan, which has gone through a big flux in energy, I guess you could say, after the nuclear problems they've had there. And geothermal is considered, at least by one guy that sits on the board of their future studies or plans for energy development. He's actually from Canada. Uh-huh. But his point, he wants to have geothermal be the basis of the new energy system for Japan. Is that even possible right now?
Well, that's a great question, John. And so no technology is perfect. And as we move forward over the next couple decades, century, we're going to see a much larger diversity of energy technologies that we just haven't relied on in the past. And the geothermal potential, and I can start talking a few numbers here if you want. I have a little thing I'd kind of like to go through in terms of just numbers, in terms of energy consumption.
Yeah.
So, and a few numbers that I did want to get across here today. One is a problem that I have my students go through on the very first day of class, and that is to sit down and sort of look at our extraction to deposit ratio. So I run them through a sort of a thought process where I say, you know, imagine that you're going to have a trust fund set up for you, and you're going to have $1 a minute put into this trust fund from the second you're born. And this every dollar is the oil that goes in the ground. And I'll get around to the geothermal in a second, because that's another question too. But every dollar you get every minute you get $1 in the ground. The question is, when do you get to retire? When do you get to start extracting that? And we sit down and say, oh, well, you know, oil and fossil fuels, coal, natural gas have been deposited, you know, for the last 2 to 3 billion years, you know, since life began. It's all of biological origin. And we started, you know, Titusville was the example, 150, 160 years ago, extracting this. And, you know, if we're at the peak or near the peak, we know it's finite. We're going to be done in about 300 years. And I have them do some math, and the ratio, the extraction to deposit ratio, ends up being 10 million to 1. And the answer is, you get to relax and retire 5 minutes before your 100th birthday. You know, and if you figure you're going to live 100 years, you get to start partying 5 minutes before your 100th birthday. So that's kind of the oil or fossil fuel party that we're right in the middle of right now.
So we're celebrating way too early.
Well, we're right at the peak. You know, the party's going strong, and we're sort of right when you know, we're cutting the cake and starting the dance and right. All that good stuff. So the 10 million to 1 ratio is really what woke me up to these statistics. We know that all the fossil fuels came ultimately from solar radiation. You have photons coming in, hitting photosystem 1, that builds the carbon bonds that plants and animals use to live. You know, we're now, for the most part, you know, burning that, sort of releasing that energy, if you will. We do have enough solar. We only consume right now 1/10,000th of the solar radiation that hits the planet.
Hang on to that thought, because we're up against a break,
sure,
which waits for no one, solar or geothermal.
All right, great.
We're going to come right back. We have all three lines open. This is fascinating stuff. I know you're listening. If you have a question or a comment, or agree or disagree, give us a call. 721-1290 is our number. We'll be right back. Poor Dr. Layton saying, man, they do this every day. Man. These guys are nuts in here. All right, 721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. John King, Peter Christian, Bob Seidenschwartz, Dr. Bradley Layton. Now, I'm going to ask Catherine to hang on for a second, but because you're right in the middle of giving us some interesting numbers. We have about 3 minutes before we have to take a hard break, so go ahead.
Okay, for sure.
Lay it on us.
I was getting into the extraction rate. So it's similar to this energy return on energy investment that Bob was talking about before. So for fossil fuels, it ends up about being 10 million to 1. So we're extracting at a rate 10 million times greater than what those fuels were put in place. Solar, like I said, we're only using about 1/10,000th of the energy that's available to us. And that's about 1,000 watts per square meter. That's what's coming sort of down from the sky. Geothermal, on average, is about 60 milliwatts per square meter. So in order to get access to the greater heat, you're going to have to drill deeper.
Go ahead.
The two new examples are a little bit more complicated for me to understand, because getting the energy from the sun is not just like dropping dollars on the earth. Right. It's not as easy to access as oil.
Right.
So can you make it a little bit easier to understand?
Absolutely. And that was the great revelation to me. And that's why in 2008 I wrote this paper, really to educate myself. And as it turns out, oil and gas are about 2 billion times more energy dense than solar and wind.
I was just going to say, the density of energy is critical to understanding this discussion.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, why don't we just go ahead and put up wind and solar and everything? Well, it's a very...
well, there's no way to store it.
That's right. And it's also very, very dilute, and it's pretty wimpy when you compare, you know, the power that's there with nuclear, gas, oil.
Or just hydro.
Or just pure hydro. But, the fact is, we're now at a place where every person on the planet has about 20 technological slaves, if you will, working for them. For each one of us, we're running at one human power. We have, on average, about 20 human powers running in the background, you know, keeping the lights on, the computers. And the average North American, it's more like 120. So we're operating at 6 times the global average. And I didn't believe it at first, but we've actually quadrupled that since 1956. So every generation, we're almost doubling the amount of energy that we consume per capita per year.
Now, here's a question along that lines. Canada, the United States, and Kuwait are the highest consumptive users of energy. China is, right now, if you break it down to barrels, is about at 20 barrels per person.
Right.
But when you consider that because of their movement from rural to urban, that actually increases to about 20 barrels. So if you take out the urban part, it's about 10. Now, China is going to be moving continually from an rural environment to an urban, which is happening all across the emerging economies, mm-hmm. which is where the next 2 billion people for the majority of the population growth in this world will occur. So when you're talking about these type of consumptive rates, then, you know, give me somewhat your forecast.
Yeah, we're going to do that. We're going to do it when we come back. I'm so sorry. We have a hard break coming up. Catherine, I really want to get your question on. We're going to have to wait till after the top of the hour break. We appreciate your patience. We're going to come right back and continue with Dr. Bradley Layden. The Montana World Affairs Council on the radio continues after this top of the hour timeout. Welcome to Talk Back, brought to you by TC Glass, Steve Daugherty in the Daugherty Law Office, Missoula Nissan Hyundai, the Mustard Seed Restaurant, Whalen Tire, and by Temprite Service. And we continue now hour number two of Talk Back. This is the Montana World Affairs Council on the Radio special edition. We do this a couple times a month here on Talk Back. And our guest in studio is Dr. Bradley Layden, who is with the University of Montana Missoula College. And Catherine has been waiting very patiently all the way through the break. Catherine, thank you for your patience. You're on. Good morning.
Oh, okay. Good morning. Okay. In any discussion on alternative energy, no one ever talks about thorium ore and thorium reactors. Canada's ahead of us in thorium reactor development. The U.S., of course, emphasized uranium. The thorium ore is widely available. In fact, the estimate is that there's over 915,000 tons in the Lemhi Pass alone between Idaho and Montana. So I'm wondering, should resources be put into the direction of developing thorium as an energy source? Why or why not?
Well, Catherine, it's interesting you'd ask that. A few people are talking about it. One of them happens to be our director of facilities, Hugh Jesse. We just had a casual conversation a few weeks ago, and he was mentioning the exact same thing. And I think we will see an evolution of nuclear power. So thorium is, in fact, radioactive. It's not as energy dense as uranium. It requires a different type of reactor in order to be developed. So, you know, I think as we see, and to a large extent, it looks like uranium may be near its peak as well. So I think, you know, as we see these conventional energies peaking, we will look to other energies, and thorium being among them.
Okay. Thank you.
That's it?
Thank you.
just one question, Catherine?
I'm sure I could come up with more.
But it was a good one.
That was okay. All right, thanks.
Thanks for the call. So let's talk about nuclear for a second, because what happened in Japan, what happened at Three Mile Island, what happened in Russia with the meltdowns, is nuclear ever going to be a really viable, you know, source of dependable energy again?
Well, it's a great question, Peter. So just like, not exactly like oil, so all of the uranium that is on the planet was here since the solar system formed, basically. And it decays naturally, so there's less uranium-235 on the planet than there was 3.8 billion years ago. Same thing with thorium. We're not making any more. So as these resources become more and more scarce, we will see them developed.
I have a real quick question. There is an alternative theory to oil production that involves pyroplankton underneath the sea, deep pressure on limestone,
sure,
made from shells of fish and things like that fall down there. I shouldn't say fish, I guess. Other things that have shells.
Sure.
What do you think about that theory, and does that throw a lot of your estimates off, it's true?
It's a really good question, and I looked into this. It's funny, my research before getting into energy technology was actually protein evolution, and a few years ago I discovered the longest collagen molecule on the planet in a bacteria. And
it's not in Michael Jackson's face.
Well, no. we'll never know now, will we?
Don't go there.
But the
hey, this is serious stuff.
But Angelina Jolie is still with us, okay? So go ahead.
So the bacteria that we discovered, it actually is responsible for these large blooms that you'll see. And so surprisingly, it had this really long collagen. So I was looking for other marine life that also had a similar collagen. One of them happened to be the tube worm. And so typically when you go online and you look up the genome for particular organisms, it's been published, but the tube worm and some of these other organisms that live near the hot eruptions in the bottom of the ocean were actually privately owned. So a lot of the oil companies had gone in and had them sequenced, I think, to try to answer the exact same question that you are. You know, is there some kind of heat-driven, a thermophilic organism that's actually down there sort of making this constantly?
Yeah, the theory, as I've heard, is that the limestone that's on the seafloor that floats down there, the shells kind of clump together, mm-hmm. and then earth pressures either thrust it up and it becomes limestone on the sea mm-hmm. up here, or it gets thrust downward under the pressure mm-hmm. of the earth, and that's where the deep pressures, which I don't think we really understand mm-hmm. a whole lot of because we can't get down there without killing ourselves, right. The deep pressures of the earth change that matter into oil or other forms.
Right.
And that's, I don't know, it seems like it could be a way to make oil.
Is that I wanted to ask for the understanding, explain it to the audience. Mm-hmm. Are you saying, in effect, that oil is being made continually in this form as opposed to what we believe is this oil being a finite source that once sure. extracted does not replenish itself? Is that the basic concept?
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Right. So to yes. answer that.
Thank you, John.
And that's where the whole Doritos theorem comes from. We'll just make more. Right. Well, feel free to use that.
I'm glad we have a scientist here to explain this to us.
So again, if the energy source, you know, for this, and it very well could be, you know, it's something that, you know, not having spent a whole lot of time down there, you know, very few, I think, who was it that just visited, Cameron just visited?
James Cameron, right.
Some of the deepest trenches. You know, until we spend more time down there, we simply won't know. But if that biophysical process is in place, chances are, just like geothermal, for example, we are capable of extracting it faster than nature can make it. So in a case like that, you know, we're relying on, again, a fairly modest energy source, geothermal, or gravity, even wimpier in a lot of cases. If you're waiting on the Earth's gravity to produce energy, you're going to be waiting a long time. Yeah.
Yeah, well, if there's a lot of matter over that gravity, I mean, that's a lot of pressure. Those forces are things that we don't understand and are extreme, probably even more powerful than geothermal. Right.
Tell you what, we're up against a break here, sure. So we're getting into some pretty deep scientific stuff. Love to have some of your questions and comments. I know you're sitting out there thinking, man, whatever happened to just going to the gas pump, filling up my tank? 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309 is our number. Dr. Bradley Layton joining us here this morning from Missoula College, and extensive training and education and background in alternative sources of energy. We like to pick his brain a little bit, find out what's ahead for all of us, and some really exciting things. So we'll be right back with more of Talk Back in a minute. 721-1290 is our number, 1-800-568-5309. You can also make your comments on our Facebook page. This is Talk Back, the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. Bob Seidenschwartz with us, John King, our show producer, Dr. Bradley Layton from the Missoula College here with us, professor in the Applied Computing and Electronics Department at Missoula College. So go ahead, John.
Okay. We've got a lot of different future techs going on simultaneously. What do you think is most likely? If you were to put money on the table right now, what will pay off in 10 years? What would you put it on?
Well, that's a great question. So if I may, I do want to go through some of the economics, because when I very first got into this field, like I said, I was working in the field of bio-nanotechnology, but I had so many students that wanted to do energy technology projects, but there just wasn't funding for it at that time. So I did sit down. And I went through some of the economics, and I think this is probably a little bit controversial, but I thought I'd throw it out there on the table. And I encourage everyone to read my paper, because when I first got into this, I said, I'm going to educate myself, because I'm sitting here just sort of fuming about our policy. You know, why are we over there guarding oil fields in Iraq instead of, you know, doing something else with our military and our money? So I sat down and did a lot of the calculations that I was going over. So the paper, you know, if people are interested in reading more about this, is published in the International Journal of Green Energy. I can talk about where I tried to have it published before that and how politicized a lot of these scientific journals can get.
I'll bet.
I was even on the phone with Jared Dime. He's like, oh, yeah, you're never going to get your stuff published in those journals. You know, there was, in fact, some of them devote entire issues to Jared Dime bashing. But it's International Journal of Green Energy.
So for those of us not in the know, Jared Diamond, you're just name dropping. We don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. About. Well, Jared Diamond has actually spent a fair amount of time in Montana. He's won the Pulitzer Prize for his book Guns, Germs, and Steel. He had another book before that, and his latest one was Collapse. So there's a lot of Jared Diamond bashing out there. You know, he's wrong about this, and he's spouting off about these apocalypses.
He's lowbrow. He's commoners reading.
He's bourgeois.
So what I really wanted to do with my paper was educate the general public. I said, if I can just sort of get this out there, get it published in Cosmo or Red Book or, you know, Field and Stream, something that everyone reads, they'll sort of get it. But as soon as the numbers start flying around, it becomes a real challenge. But for those of you who are interested, it's my paper, Bradley Layton, 2008, International Journal of Green Energy.
We're gonna link it to our Facebook page.
You can find it online.
Are you really gonna get some hits now? We put it on our Facebook page.
People are gonna read
good.
It.
I know.
And off it goes. It's gonna be off the charts.
So Bradley, give us the premise. Give us your hypothesis.
Right.
And then what came out of this, as far as some of the conclusions. As a result of the paper.
I certainly will, because obviously energy and money are in lockstep with each other. It costs a certain amount of dollars per joule, regardless of the energy technology. So what I did, I looked and saw how much oil is left under the sands in the Middle East. So there are approximately 1.5 trillion barrels of oil left on the planet. That's sort of the generally accepted rule, you know, with the thermally produced stuff at the bottom of the ocean aside. So 1.5 trillion barrels remain. So if you're going at $100 a barrel, that's $150 trillion left in sort of oil money on the planet. Approximately 10% of that is in Iraq. The global GDP is $90 trillion. Our national debt is at about $9 trillion. So when I looked at it, I said, if we can gain access to that oil, what's the cost benefit of actually going to get it? So if you looked at some of the statistics during the Iraq War, you know, so what Iraq would sue the United States for was about $8 million per person. That's approximately what we spend on a U.S. soldier who goes over there. So if you look at the cost of the war versus the amount of oil that's left there, it's about a 7.5-to-1 return on your investment. So
you made an economic case for invading Iraq.
Well,
I can't imagine how you would have been thrown out on your neck.
I was not in the room when those decisions were made, obviously. But you know, if I were doing the numbers, you know, that was your question. You know, what's the economic or what's the best way to go economically? You know, if you're willing to take that political hit, you know, we all saw Colin Powell up there with the Picasso painting covered, you know, during his talk. You know, if you're willing to take that political hit, then sure, a lot of times economically going after these unsustainable practices does make sense, unfortunately.
Yeah. Earlier, I'm sorry, Peter.
No, it's all right. Yeah.
I wanted to ask, you mentioned how much oil is left.
Right.
And you mentioned the Middle East.
Right.
Now, there's another part of the economic story here, too. The Saudis have at least publicly said, or figures have come out that said, the Saudis have X amount of reserves.
Mm-hmm.
There are some out there who have said that they have grossly overestimated
mm-hmm.
their reserves. Now, and this is something because they don't allow or publish this information.
Right.
What are the sources that we have to rely on as citizens and from a military, from a planning standpoint, to actually be able to validate the accuracy or not? Because there's some major implications. Let's say the Saudis have overestimated by 30 to 40%
mm-hmm.
their reserves.
Yeah.
That's a game changer.
Yeah, Bob, it's a really good question. And one thing that I've been trying to pull into my research is the whole notion or aspect of game theory. So if you've heard of John Nash, The Beautiful Mind, it's typically not in one's interest to tell the truth about these things. You know, why would you disclose what you have? Because if you can artificially create a shortage, then your resources become more valuable. So I don't know, to a large extent, it's impossible to know until it happens, you know, until the well runs dry.
Or if the oil companies are doing it now.
Right. Well, we're going to take a little break because we have two callers, Harry and Jim, and I want to give you guys plenty of time to make your comments without cutting you off. And so we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more of Talk Back in a moment. Our guest, Dr. Bradley Layton on the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. We will continue here in a moment. This is Talk Back, 721-1290, 1-800-568-5309. And Bob Seidenschwartz with us this morning at the Montana World Affairs Council on the radio. John King, our show producer, and Dr. Bradley Layton joining us here in studio this morning from the Missoula College. Okay, we're right in the middle of an interesting discussion, so Please, please continue. Go ahead.
Oh, we lost him.
Anyway. Go ahead, John.
Yeah. I think you were going to explain to me what the most likely bet is for future energy.
Right, right. And so I kind of went through the economics a little bit of global oil. And every region on the planet is going to have its own sort of solution as fossil fuels dwindle. We already see that Denmark, for example, makes not the majority, but a growing amount of its energy from wind, for example. Germany, a few days last summer, was able to make over half of its energy from solar. France is nuclear. So I think we're going to start to see a greater and greater diversity of energy sources as we move forward. So it's going to depend a lot on what's just available locally. You know, the grid will be a, you know, one source of getting these local energy sources out and distributed. But I think we're also going to see a lot of microgrid technology.
So microgrid Montana for me. We have a giant volcano in Yellowstone Park. Is geothermal an option? We also have hydro. So is that an option? What's the most likely option for mice?
Right, right. So the amazing thing about Montana is we have a surplus of energy. We have way more energy than we can use.
Yeah, we're an energy exporter.
Absolutely. And so one of the other really interesting things about the economics that I've just started to understand is that, for example, from Northwestern Energy, you can go and get a grant and you can have a large fraction of your solar array or your wind turbine paid for by Northwestern Energy. And that kind of just seemed crazy to me at first. You know, why would Northwestern Energy do that? Well, in Montana, where energy is so inexpensive, they would much rather have Montanans, in a lot of ways, off the grid, so to speak, and then charge more in more heavily populated areas. So I've got great examples of a few friends of mine, my friend Jeff Couch being one of them, who was able to put solar panels on his roof, only 2 kilowatts of electricity, and he pays about $5 a month for energy now. Bob and I were talking about that
wow.
way over, and the payback, you know, with the grants and things that you can get from Northwestern Energy ends up being 5 or 6 years, you know, pretty modest.
Okay, let's get to the phone. Todd, good morning, and thanks for calling TalkBack. Hi.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Excellent. What's on your mind, sir?
Hey, I was just kind of wondering about hydro dams and the energy they produce and the future of them. How does this gentleman feel about that?
Well, it's a good question, Todd. So I think to a large extent, hydro was in its heyday. You know, for example, the Hoover Dam was built, the dams near Las Vegas, and to a large extent, we've pretty much tapped out the hydro. I mean, there is still potential around the world, but globally, you know,
the water's not going anywhere.
The water's not going away. As long as the sun's shining and driving those molecules up in the air, and it rains, there will be hydro. But in terms of, you know, saturation, you know. China, for example, just dammed up their, you know, the Three Gorges River. I don't think we're going to see projects quite that large. It's, you know, we dammed up some of the largest rivers on the planet. There's just not a whole lot left to do.
Well, they got a billion people they need to heat, too. So
it is amazing. So I think we might see some micro hydro, you know, things that are a little disruptive to the ecosystem. It'd be great to see little micro hydro people doing this sort of on their own with streams and rivers that aren't as disruptive as some of these bigger projects.
Now, I realize this may be just a little bit off the subject, but when it comes to hydro, there something needs to be said about water rights, because there's a huge fight going on right now between the tribes and the state and the people who use irrigation and that sort of thing as to, you know, this whole water rights compact thing. Because when you're talking about hydroelectricity, a lot of that has to do with who owns the water in the first place, does it not?
Absolutely, yeah. And again, it goes back to a lot of these other things, even starting back with the Poland issue is, you know, it's great to have electricity, but you don't necessarily want it in your backyard.
Right. And right. Peter, we were discussing this on the way over this morning.
Hang on just a second. Go ahead, Todd.
I just personally love to see them dams myself. I know a lot of people don't. They're very adamant about – actually, I keep hearing things about people that would like to see the dams come out of the gorge over in Washington and Oregon. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be just a massive mistake, because that not only creates energy, but it creates a way to combat a drought by holding back water to use for farming and stuff. And recently I've heard a few people talking about the dams over there, and that's why I sort of brought it up, because it seems like when people start talking about things, it's shortly after that You start hearing about pulling the dams out and stuff like that again. And I just kind of wanted to know and let people know how important them dams are to farming and food production, not just creating electricity.
Sure. So, all right.
Hey. No, it's a really good point.
Thanks, Todd.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
And along the lines of what Todd's saying is, if you look at the most important resource on the planet, it's water.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's going to be another major war, the likelihood is going to be fought probably over water, not necessarily water rights in the state of Montana, but Syria and Turkey almost went to war several years ago over water issues. And this will continue to become more important as the years go on, because it goes back to Todd's point, agriculture. Mm-hmm. If you can't produce food, you can't feed people. And if you don't have water, you can't produce.
All right. Let's get back to the phone. Matt, you're on Talkback. Hi.
Hey. The only problem I see with solar power is that it only works when the sun is shining, i.e. during the day. And when do people need lights at night? So it's storage. The key, the linchpin to solar power is a limited discharge capacitor. Without that, you'll be the richest man in the world. Bill Gates will look like a pauper compared to you.
Right.
As far as water rights, planet is 75% water. No, it needs to be desalinated, but that just takes electricity.
Takes a tremendous amount of capital also to do that.
Right.
Well, the thing is you're looking large scale. You know, a small scale, you can do arable lands. I mean, this is all technology we have. It's just that it's misapplied. Otherwise, you know, you have to look at hydropower, because everything is either coal fire or hydropower. Those are the only two constant sources of electricity we have. You know, everybody wants the Chevy Volt or the Nissan Leaf. Those are coal-powered cars.
Yeah, you know, Matt, you make a really good point, and storage is a huge issue.
Thanks, Matt.
And there are all kinds of different ways to store it. So one example is pump storage. So so if you have excess wind, excess solar coming online, one way to tie the sun and water together is pump storage. We've done a few back of the envelope calculations, and if you've been to the university's campus, there's a building there, the Mansfield Library. And just some pretty simple calculations could show that if you put a building about the size of the Mansfield Library on top of Mount Sentinel and filled that each day with excess energy from the sun or the wind, for example, you could run the entire university. So the math is in place and the physics are in place to do some of these sustainable and renewable technologies. It just takes political will and some smart economics in a lot of cases.
All right, we're going to take a little break. Dr. Bradley Layton is with us here this morning, along with Bob Seidenschwartz, the Montana World Affairs Council. On the right. By the way, we appreciate you coming to the studio. This is great. Thank you. And we're going to get John and Dave, and we have one line open for you at 721-1290. We're talking about energy technology and how it affects our future, and that's all of us, folks. So if you have a question, give us a call. I've been regaling Dr. Layton with my scientific expertise. He's just kind of going, what?
He's not a knowledge of physics.
It's like getting a class all over
the street. You mean it doesn't? Anyway, 721-1290 is our number. We've got all three lines of humming here. So let's get right back to the phones, because everybody wants to visit with Dr. Layton. John, thanks for holding. You're on Talkback. Good morning.
Good morning. I just want to switch gears a little bit to natural gas. Apparently, the United States has more natural gas than can be quantified, because every time a number comes out, it's already outdated and there's a new number. So it's clean burning, it's efficient, and it's abundant, and we're just burning it off, letting it go into the atmosphere. So I'd just like to hear his take on that.
Yeah, John, that's a great question, and it really comes back to these same issues about extraction technology. So it used to be that we'd burn off a lot more of the natural gas than we used to, and it's
to use a bad word, sequester, right? You got to capture it,
right? And that takes a technology as well. So a lot of times you'll see the natural gas. It's methane, it's CH4. It's basically the simplest hydrocarbon you can have. It's one carbon atom and four hydrogens. So you're going to find that along with your longer chain hydrocarbons with the coal and oil in general. unless you have the technology to capture it, you're just like you said, it is wasted. Methane is a greenhouse gas, as we probably all know. It's just that molecule is capable of taking a photon and turning it into heat much better than anything else in the atmosphere. So probably better in a lot of ways to go ahead and use that methane, use that natural gas to make energy. The byproducts ends up being CO2 and water, and we all know about CO2.
Now, I'm sorry. I just wanted to, and this is a real good example of economic lessons right here. We have abundance of natural gas as a result of a new technology development, which is fracking and horizontal drilling.
Right.
Now, what's happened is the game has gotten a little bit ahead of our ability to store it, build out the necessary infrastructure. If we want to make conversions from fuel-based, gasoline to natural gas to run our automobiles, which is being mandated in various parts of the country, particularly with transportation fleets, we don't yet, but it's being built, but we are not even close yet to having a ubiquitous number of stations that would make it possible for you to travel as you can travel now using gasoline. So this also becomes an issue of politics. It becomes an environmental issue, becomes a legislative issue, because as a result of the natural gas development, fracking is potentially very problematic. So we are probably going to see a slowing to some degree of maybe some of this development as they look at what the potential environmental consequences are.
Anything else, John?
Well, it's just he was right about the money. Money drives energy, and it's all the powers that be, the Al Gores of the world, they've all invested, and they've embedded themselves with the government, and it's all about getting the taxpayers' dollars to fund your cause, and same with grants and the whole deal. It's just stealing from Peter to pay Paul, if you will. That's just the way it's going.
Well, John, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. All right, let's get Dave on the line. Dave, thanks for holding. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. You talked about storing energy. What's the latest on battery technology? Is there anything in the works that charges batteries quicker?
Yeah, Matt had mentioned that. The person advanced that. They're rich beyond their wildest dream.
Right. Dave, it's a great question. There are a lot of new battery technologies coming online. So the majority that we've seen in the past have been lead acid. It's a fairly simple technology. Some of the other things that are coming online now actually require the batteries to operate at much higher temperatures. You might also see supercapacitors. So there are a tremendous number of sort of larger community scale battery technologies that are coming out. The number of patents that are filed just on batteries alone are tremendous right now.
I heard that GE was using batteries on their wind farms now to make them more predictable and made it easier to integrate into the grid.
Yeah, I don't see how, why you wouldn't. As long as the battery technology that you invest in has a lifespan that's going to last over the lifetime of the wind farm, that's the most readily available way to store it, rather than the pump storage I was speaking about.
Dave,
before.
Dave, anything else?
Yeah. As far as dams go, it's a real problem, and you can't turn them off at night when you don't really need them. So there is a lot of wasted electricity in the system that's just not used. If we could store that, it would be a great advantage.
All right. Well, Dave, thanks for your call.
Yeah.
Appreciate it. All right. Let's get, Alan is online, too. Alan, good morning. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead.
Good morning. We hear a lot about renewable or sustainable energy. Everything that we do, wind, solar, require manufacturing and mining and minerals.
Absolutely.
And we use these minerals to produce these products. We have to produce a lot of energy. So the whole idea of a renewable or sustainable really isn't true. There's nothing that way. For example,
in other words, nothing stands alone.
That's right.
That's
for example, we require a tremendous amount of rare earth minerals when we build solar panels. There is a limited supply of rare earth minerals. Mm-hmm. We have copper in our wind, and that requires mining, and our copper supply is limited. Of course, some of it is reusable, but they're finding that these wind turbines are burning out at a much higher rate, much faster than originally anticipated. They're finding out that they have to shut these wind turbines down. If it's too warm, too cold, the wind blows too high. So nothing is really renewable or sustainable. It is just less consuming than certain other products. And then I wanted to mention one other thing, just a theoretical here. I heard mention of, we all know about carbon dioxide. What would planet Earth look like if, for example, there was some way to eliminate all carbon dioxide? And I'll just listen off the air.
Okay. Thanks so much, Alan. We're going to take a little break, and Dr. Layton is anxious to answer your questions. Glenn, we're going to get you on here in just a minute. And the other line is ringing, 721-1290 or 1-800-568-5309. TalkBack continues here in a moment. Okay, class, hope you're paying attention. There will be a test when this is all over. It's 30% of your grade, so just in case you're wondering. 721-1290 is our number. This is TalkBack. I'm Peter Christian, and I'm the dunce. I've got the cap. The hope it's actually a pair of headphones. But anyway, Bob Seidenschwartz over there from the Montana World Affairs Council, John King, and our guest in studio is Dr. Bradley Layton. Now, Alan asked some rather intriguing questions, so I want to give you a chance to respond to some of his comments.
He did, and the question he asked is really, you know, what are the externalities, if you will, and what's the actual sustainability horizon of these so-called sustainable or alternative technologies? So I was really amazed when I first started looking at this, what the embodied energy is of a solar cell. So it's something like 1,000 times. If you want to make just a kilogram of fully crystallized silicon, it's about 1,000 times the energy to make that same quantity of mass of an aluminum can. Now, the aluminum can is not going to give you energy back, right? It's going to just sort of end up in the landfill. You might get a few cents for it at the recycling center. But the energy that's embodied in the PV, and this is true of any technology, it's going to pay you back eventually. So it's true. A lot of neodymium goes into the magnets that go into the wind turbines. You mentioned the fact that a lot of them fail. And that's true of any technology. There's no technology that's going to be with us forever.
And don't forget copper, too.
The lever.
The lever will be. The simple machine will be with us forever, which is my discipline, mechanical engineering. So anytime I can think of a way to simplify things, I do. So just to get back to it, though, if you want to read a couple others of my papers, I've got this theory of mechanoevolution, if you will. And this is something that I started thinking about a few years before the energy tech stuff that I was researching. Before I coined the phrase, I think the only other person who had used it was Eddie Vedder when I went to Google it. Now you'll see the term mechanoevolution out there.
Well, that was the name of my band when I was in high school.
Maybe that's what Eddie was talking about, Peter. I don't know. But no, as we move forward, we will see greater efficiencies in our technologies. One thing that I'd love to see, and there's a little bit of research out now, but just using photosystem one that I was mentioning in plants. So nature's got this figured out. Nature can actually do all of this at ambient temperature. Right now, you know, we're really very much in our infancy in terms of energy technology. Everything has to be hot. Everything has to be noisy. Everything has to be loud. But I think as we move forward, we'll see, you know, quieter, more efficient, more biologically inspired technologies.
Yeah, and Bradley, isn't that really one of the issues that we face in terms of, for every barrel of oil we extract, the amount of actual energy that is lost in the chain before it gets to us as the end user is tremendous. So any efficiencies that can be developed along that chain before you plug it in, drive it, or blow dry your hair can lend itself to having to use less oil at the inception in terms of extraction.
Yeah, Bob, it's a really, really great point. And so the concept that you want to understand on that is Carnot efficiency. So most of our engines that we use are, in fact, heat engines. And Carnot was thinking about this in the 1850s when there were steam locomotions. He said, how can I make these engines more efficient? Well, if it's a thermal engine, you can never do better than what the ratio is between the operating temperature and the atmospheric temperature. So the hotter you can get it, the more efficient it can be. So if you're at, say, 600 Kelvin, which is double atmospheric temperature, the best you can do is 50% efficiency. So it's true. Anytime you have a thermal engine, best you're going to be able to do is maybe 30%. So there's a tremendous amount lost.
So is one of the answers to our usage of energy going forward to increase these efficiencies, thereby slowing the rate of extraction?
Okay, let's get back to the phone. Glenn, you're on TalkBack. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes, all right, Dr. Layton. I've got a lift here south of Hamilton, and we have a an artesian spring that puts out about 100 gallons a minute. And I was going to, I'm in the process of hooking up a ram pump, and I was just wondering, does that even fit in the scheme of things that you're talking about, and what do you know about ram pumps? And I would like to listen off the air if I could. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Well, he's a mechanical engineer, so
right.
I see the wheels turning. Yeah.
So the ram pump is sort of a good strategy for extracting the kinetic energy of the water. So the water's coming out of your well at 100 gallons per minute. The amount of energy that you can extract is going to depend not only on that flow rate, but also on the amount of head that you have, the amount of pressure, the amount of drop. So if you multiply those two numbers together, basically your 100 gallons per minute times however far it drops, that'll give you your power rating. And in fact, we've got a class coming up here. And Glenn, it'd be great to see more guys like you come to our Summer Energy Practicum course that we teach. This is going to start the week after Memorial Day, so June 3rd. And we actually have a micro hydro project that we're planning to do in the Bitterroot. So
is that something you'd have to like register for and pay the class, or how does that work?
You would. Right now we have 10 to 15 students enrolled. We've got a capacity of 25, and we'd love to see another 10. But tuition at Missoula College is relatively inexpensive.
It really is.
And we're hoping, and in fact, after I leave here today, I've got a meeting with Missoula County Public Schools to look at dual credits. So I think we'll probably have some high school students joining us as well in some projects, just like the one you're talking about, Glenn. So I'd love to talk about it more.
So let's get, I believe this is Jim. Jim, thanks for holding. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Hey, I've been a diesel mechanic for probably 27 years, and I've been, you know, involved with several types of fuel systems over the years. And everybody knows that it's fact that diesel is the most efficient internal combustion engine in the world. And what I've seen is politics come into play over the years. I mean, I remember in the late 90s, you know, like a full-size Cummins diesel truck was getting 20 miles to the gallon. And then all of a sudden EPA comes in, tightens everything up, makes it electronic, gives it 24 valves, going to be more efficient, and actually they won't get more than 15 miles to the gallon. And at one point, diesel fuel also, they were saying we were going to be going to diesel with even automotive. It was always about $1 a gallon less. And then all of a sudden, what happened? Diesel fuel becomes super, you know, more expensive than gas. And you know what I'm saying? Why aren't we just keeping things more efficient with diesel? What happened?
All right, let's let him answer that. Thanks for your call.
Sure, Jim. Well,
go ahead.
It's a really good question, and the reason that diesel is more efficient than gasoline is for the reason I just previously mentioned. So it's Carnot efficiency, and so a diesel engine can operate at much higher pressures, much higher temperatures. So whenever you get that temperature up higher, it is going to be more efficient. And the extra anti-pollution systems that you just mentioned, in general, are going to make things less efficient. So it's the same thing with trying to make coal cleaner. Every single gadget, as you know, you make it more complex, it's going to break down more frequently, and sometimes the consequences are not exactly what you intended when you started out in the first place. Of just sort of keeping the old school tech going.
We're going to take a little break here. Dr. Bradley Layton joining us today. I have a funny feeling. I wish we could keep him for another hour, but I don't think Rush would like that. So, it's a Rush who? We have two mics. Mike and Mike are waiting to visit. We'll be right back after this quick one-minute timeout.
We have one.
Only about 7.5 minutes left in the show, and it is going way, 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 way too fast. Dr. Bradley Layton, kind enough to spend an hour and a half of his very valuable time with us here on TalkBack this morning from Missoula College, talking about energy. So let's get, we have Mike and Mike, and the first Mike. Mike, good morning. You're on TalkBack. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Great program, by the way. I remember reading an article a few years back about flywheel technology, about a couple of scientists working on an engine for a car that was made with a heavy-duty flywheel and a vacuum that would store the electrical energy and then change that to mechanical energy. Have you heard anything lately about that?
Sure. It's a great question, Mike. So a couple of the projects that we build with my students, one's a human-powered vehicle and the other one's an electric car. And we sort of toy with this idea all the time. And as it turns out, the energy density of a flywheel is just so wimpy, especially for transportation. There are flywheel technologies that are in place for running computer servers, for example. You know, if you have a little glitch or a brownout or something and you need that thing to come back online, flywheel can keep it going, but only for a short time. The energy density is just so modest mechanically compared to what you get chemically out of the other technologies we've been discussing.
Okay, let's get the other mic on. Mike, thanks for holding. You're on TalkBack.
Hey, good morning. I had a point to make. I was listening to your show this morning about the solar and the wind energies, and I have to agree with the caller that a little earlier that was talking about, you know, if we don't have it, we have to dig it up. I believe, in my research, I believe that the most that we can get efficiency in a solar cell, if I'm not mistaken, is 30.4%, and that's in a laboratory setting. And what you can get commercially, I think, is somewhere going to be at the high end, around 19% efficiency on a solar cell.
That's correct, yep.
Additionally, we talk about small wind as a viable alternative to fossil fuel energy sources. But as was discussed earlier in the show, small wind tends to burn out a lot faster than people expect. So we're seeing a lot more energy being put into maintenance of these systems.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying the windmill repairman would not be the loneliest man in town?
So my point being, I hear a lot of bad press about fracking and about opening ANWR for drilling. And these are things that I think are being very blown out of proportion by the liberal mindset, the save the environment mindset, if you will. If I remember in my reading, the footprint for the drill area in ANWR would have been something like 20 acres out of several hundred thousand. So my question would be, I guess, to the an open question to the people that are against all these current technologies. You know, do you eat? Do you drive? Do you dress?
Yeah.
Do you use anything at all?
Right.
And if you do, then fossil fuels is what got us here, and fossil fuels is what's going to get us to the next level of technology to compete effectively in alternative energy sources such as small wind and solar.
Okay, Mike, thanks for the call.
Yeah. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, no, you make a really good point, Mike, and obviously we are in a lot of ways married to the technologies that we're living with today, and it's a big boat to turn around. So if we are to go to these more sustainable technologies, it's gonna take investment. It's gonna take money from oil companies, frankly, and a lot of the larger petroleum companies, coal companies, are in a position to fund this sort of next generation of technology. And I think what you'll find is they're gonna make the decisions that are most economically viable. And a lot of times we will make environmental decisions that have negative impacts, that don't really get us to where we need to be in terms of sustainability.
We have a question about, this is from Riley. He says, how do you justify solar and wind as clean energy when, as we speak, there is core drilling being conducted near Limhi Pass looking for enough rare earth minerals to open a strip mine to supply the minerals to the wind and solar industry?
Right. No, it's a great question. And there's no perfect technology. There's no technology out there that's going to save the environment or save the planet. There's always some kind of externality associated with every single technology that's out there.
There's no anti-thermodynamics machine.
No, I don't think we're going back in terms of the – and that gets back to that mechano-evolution question I'd love to talk about more.
And Bradley, even before we get to all these evolving and emerging technologies, do we not need to build out our infrastructure in this country? Are we getting ahead of ourselves here? Because our infrastructure, as we were talking off air, is in disarray.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has said from a usage standpoint that if you brought all this electric use on, mm-hmm. as with cars and solar and everything else, mm-hmm. you don't have the grid system to handle this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, Bob, we are going to see a big change, I think. I think we're going to see more, like I was saying sort of at the beginning of the show, more distributed power systems, smaller power systems feeding into the grid. But
in that light, do you like Stephen Cho's transmission grid upgrade idea?
Oh, the Secretary of Energy? I guess I don't know all of the details, but let me know.
Oh, well.
Yeah,
it's too deep for me. I'm sorry. Basically, transmission grids to put the five different grids that we have currently in America, kind of link them together so they can share energy quicker. Basically, we take energy from net producing states like Montana, ship it over to California, Washington.
Right.
Make it easier to use wind energy on a wider scale.
Oh, that would be one big solution to the intermittency of renewable energies.
Well, we have a minute and a half left in the show, so first of all, I want to say thank you for being with
us. It's been great. Thanks for having me.
Now, just in 1 minute, can you capsulize, if you will, where you guys are headed at the College of Technology or the Missoula College, what you're trying to teach your students to achieve in their careers as they head forward?
Sure. Well, the program that we develop is very diverse. We've tried to make, just in 2 short years, a large suite of energy technologies available available to the students, because we know that the energy supply is going to become more and more diverse. So we aren't sort of pushing or promoting any one particular technology. We're educating the students to let them know, you know, what's happening now and where we're going to be in the future with a variety of technology.
You explained the ratio of energy production for aluminum cans earlier. Oh, what is it for Keystone Oil?
For Keystone Oil, well, I think like Bob was saying before, it's just down in the single digits already. You know, and the break even point where it's a barrel of oil to get a barrel out, that's when you quit. But it's already approaching that in a lot of ways. It's down to single digits.
All right. Well, again, I want to thank you for being with us. If folks want to get more information about your research and about the college, the Missoula College, what do they do? How do they go?
I'm pretty easy to find. I think I'm the first Brad Layton or Bradley Layton that you find when you Google me. I've got one website that's been going on forever, but we also have a website there at the Missoula College.
Great.
So thanks for having us.
Thank you for being with us and sharing your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
And thanks for your patience with all of our silliness.
Oh, no.
We do that a lot around here. So what's coming up tomorrow, John?
For the first half hour, we'll be talking about suicide in Montana. And then it's open phones.
All right. Again, thanks so much. Thank you, Bob.
I'll see you in about 2 weeks, guys.
Always a pleasure. And we will be back tomorrow morning at 8:30.